You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Okay.
Right.
Now, Don and Phoebe, this is a privilege, really, and an honour. And I'm excited to do this, Don, because
I'm going to be, what's the word when you, self, yeah, I know.
What,
I know.
Don? What's that, Don?
Well, I'm looking forward to this interview as well, because I'm going to be self-indulgent, because growing up, this man was...
So, I don't mind, this man will understand when I say this. This man is five sets off 100. He's 95 years old, and he is the oldest person that we've ever interviewed on this. We interviewed Ron Taylor, who was 92 or 3. But this man is an Australian sporting legend, and he's, as I say, a five-setter off 100. And what an honour it is to speak to him. And I'm going to start by not asking him about his chosen sport. I'm going to ask him about, what at 95, what has he seen in this life? Because, Don, we can only imagine what this is all about. And we're getting there slowly, or no slower than he's getting to 100, but it'll be interesting to know. So this is the great Frank Sedgman, great tennis player, Wimbledon star, five-time major star. We'll go through all his credentials, but I just want to welcome you, Frank, and I want to ask you firstly, in the 95 years you've been on the planet, you just can't believe how it has changed, and what have you noticed most, Frank, if I could ask you that to start with. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Sam, but I've been through the building up of the tennis empire. I was an amateur as a kid, and I played Wimbledon as an amateur. I was lucky enough to have a friend, Harry Hopman was lucky enough to have a friend who lived in New York, and he paid my expenses to go to Wimbledon the first time with Harry Hopman.
In what year?
1948.
48. You won it in 52.
Yeah.
How much did you win, money-wise?
No. I got a £25... voucher to buy something with that.
Did you fly or go by boat, Frank?
With Harry Hopman, the first year I went, I was 1948. I went with Harry Hopman on a flying boat out of Sydney, and it took 5 days to get there because the aeroplane wasn't. Set up to go at night. You couldn't fly at night. Wasn't pressurised, so you had to land on water. And you had to go to... We went to Bali and then to Colombo.
Land on water.
And all that, just to land there. And we finally got to Bournemouth in London, in England, and we had to catch a train up to London, and we went out to Wimbledon, and that's when I had my first hit at Wimbledon. In 1948, and I was lucky enough to play with John Bromwich,
yep,
who was our number one player in Australia, and he was playing Davis Cup for Australia, but he wanted to go to Wimbledon on his own because he was hamstrung with other players in the Davis Cup team. It was Quist and a few other guys.
Adrian Quist.
Well, they were the Davis Cup players, and they were playing the Yanks after the war. And the Yanks won the Davis Cup.
Yep.
And they got beaten by the Yanks most a couple of years. And so anyway, Bromwich decided to go to Wimbledon on his own, and he didn't have a partner, so I was lucky enough to play with him, and I won the Wimbledon title that year with him, 1948. But I lost in the first round of the singles to a fellow called Falkenberg.
Now, I've not heard of him.
Now, he had a sister called Jinx. Jinx Falkenberg, she was a film star
Jinx
in Hollywood.
Jinx Falkenberg.
And he was a good tennis player, but
you weren't interested in Jinx, were you?
No.
No.
Well, she was much older than me.
A whippersnapper.
I was only 20 year older, you know. But anyway, I won the title with Bromwich, and then Hopman, he decided that we changed the Davis Cup team and leave all the older guys out, and then there was myself and McGregor and Rose and Hartwig. We played Davis Cup for Australia, and we beat the Yanks to bring the Davis Cup back to Australia.
So, Frank, we have a very eclectic listening audience, and most of them aren't as old as you and I, Don, and they're certainly not as old as you. So just for the sake of the people listening, Harry Hopman was the absolute legendary master tennis coach of the Australian tennis scene, wasn't he?
Yeah, and, you had to do what?
Disciplinarian,
he said,
a bit like Percy Cerity.
Yep. You had to do, if you didn't follow his instructions, you were out.
But so society was different back then, wasn't it? You were told by your parents it wasn't, you never questioned them, you never questioned authority. And so people, well, it was just different, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you couldn't play up or do anything wrong. And if you did, you'd get wiped out of the team, you know. You had to follow what Hopman said and go along with him. And he had a class at Kooyong every Thursday, mostly with Scotch kids, you know, Scotch boys just across the road from Kooyong or across the creek from Kooyong. And he'd coach them, and he invited me to come and be a guest of his as in the coaching class. But it was only once a week. But I was able to beat most of all the Scotch kids, and so I was able to play Davis Cup for Australia.
You grew up in Mount Albert?
No, Blackburn.
Blackburn.
Yeah.
Now, I've watched you. I'm in awe here because growing up I had tennis lessons, and back in those days we had Slazenger rackets and Dunlop rackets and Max Ply, and your face was on with Lou Hode, Pancho Gonzalez and Frank Sedgwin.
Yeah, right. How
now,
you,
so
you've got
I'm
a good
little
memory.
Bit of, I'm a little bit in awe of yeah. you. But watching you play tennis, you were an unbelievable mover. You were an athlete and just so graceful. Why did you pick tennis? Because I reckon you could have played football.
Well, I had a run with Carlton a couple of times, and was only, I was teasing Sam here about he couldn't kick left-footed. Well, I couldn't. So that was a finish of me as a footballer, because you got to be able to kick left and right-footed. And I also, while I was practising with Carlton, I got slung by Jim Mooring with a body tackle, and he threw me, you know, I got a really bad strain on my leg, on my thigh. And I couldn't walk for a week because he'd thrown me into a tackle, you know. And I said, oh, geez, that's the end of football for me. I didn't want to get injured like that again because I just couldn't play tennis.
Speaking to Frank Sedgman, Don, and just in case people are just coming into this a little late. The names that Frank has been associated with, we know them all, but they're just like household names of Hode and Cooper and Rosewall and Fraser and McGregor and Bromwich and Emerson and later on in Newcomb and Cash. I know they're not in his era. Laver, was your...
He was a bit younger than me. Yeah.
But I was going to say, everyone's a bit younger than you, Frank.
Yep.
Because you've outlasted them all, and your mental acuity is extraordinary. You are as sharp as a tack, you are, and it's fantastic to speak to you. But Rod Laver said, you are responsible. You, Frank Sedgman, are responsible for the modern game of serve and volley.
That's right, yeah.
And which he took over and perfected it. So yeah. You've got that fantastic accolade from one of probably the greatest.
Yeah. Well, do you think? I was... Well, Hopman got hold of me and he said, you need building up. So he sent me to a gym in Little Collins Street.
Frank Not the Fenn- one you acquired later in
yeah,
life.
Yeah, yeah.
With Stan Nichols.
Yeah.
I'll be buggered.
Yeah, well, that was Frank Finley's gym, as it was called, and I was able, I went there and he did me, you know, I did all the weights and all the things to build up my strength a lot, and anyway, his son got killed in a car accident, so he said, I'm out of the business, he said, and I was in the stage of where I wanted to get into some sort of a business, and I bought the gym, and I bought Frank Finley's gym, and that's where I spent all my time effort in that gym with Stan Nichols, who was he was the manager of it, and he was fantastic because he had the experience of doing the right things with the different players, like if you're in a runner, you'd have to work on the muscles to use to run, and yet if you're a tennis player, you need a strong shoulders and strong back so you could serve well, and that's the experience I had, and he guided me in my effort to become a good tennis player.
Frank, in a congratulatory message from an eight-time Wimbledon champion, Roger Federer, he said this about you at a function. This is Roger Federer, I'm quoting. Back in the day, we were not aware of all the things you were doing for tennis, but I hope you know that I am still one of the older guys who will never forget where the game came from, said the eight-time Wimbledon champion. You have marked our wonderful sport like so many of the great friends of yours and legends that have paved the way for us. So even the greatest, do you think he was the greatest? So we get down, Frank, to maybe Federer or Lendl or McEnroe or Sampras. This is in the more contemporary era.
You can know all the names, Sam. You're pretty good.
Can you put a person on the pedestal, or is it a bit hard to?
I ran into Federer while I was playing at Wimbledon. He was coming in, and I was, you know, going out. But he changed the way the game was played. In the old days, when you were playing, you'd generally attack the player's backhand and you'd serve to his backhand, you'd come in, you'd volley to his backhand, and because generally that was the weakest part of the opposition's game. And he changed it all because you'd play against Federer, he could do these half volley drives at an angle.
Yep.
And
with one hand, not the two-handed backhand.
Not the two-handed backhand.
He was
backhand.
The traditional...
And he could put the ball away off the backhand with a half-volley drive.
Yep.
And I'd never seen that before.
But, Frank, how can you compare eras? Now, you played with wooden rackets, smaller heads.
Yep.
Whereas these... And I should imagine the stringing of the racket is much different to when you played as to the way it is, also the gut that they're using. How can you compare eras with regard to who's good and who's not?
Yeah, well, that was the thing with Federer. He was introduced to the metal rackets, and we were using wooden rackets. And they used to say to me, they brought out a huge one time, And I tried it, and gee, it was too hard to control the ball with it because of, you know, it was like a sling.
Like a trampoline.
Yeah, it was like a trampoline hitting the ball. But they reduced it to the size of a modern-day tennis racket, and it's much better than the wooden rackets that you used to use, you know.
Yep.
With the wooden racket, didn't have any flexibility. It was hard to serve with and all that sort of thing. But you got one of these metal rackets and gee,
so it was
easier. It made it much easier to play
that's
tennis.
That's what I'm saying. So how can you compare players of that era?
Well, you can't. No, exactly, but, right. But that's why I say Federer was the one that sort of brought it all in, and he could control it all. You know, he had a forehand, and a terrific forehand, and this half backhand drive that he introduced, we'd never seen that before.
And Lendl, I think, had one of the big wooden framed Donnet rackets, didn't he? And he started that. He was a double-handed backhander, wasn't he? I think Lendl.
I don't know. Can't remember. Lendl was a single.
Speaking of people who gave you accolades, Frank, Jack Cramer, the great tennis promoter, he said that you were in the top 21, if you think of all the great players, the top 21 players of all time, that is some sort of just to be, that's like the team of the century, to be put into the top 21 of all the people that we've mentioned and all the people that we haven't mentioned. To be in the top 21, as mentioned by Jack Cramer, is some sort of a feat,
Well,
Frank.
He was a great player. I played, this is the way that I was brought up, that you played Davis Cup and you had to play in the major championships. Yep. To
you
make
won
a
five
name
of them.
For yourself.
You won five majors.
Yeah.
Wimbledon.
I won Wimbledon.
Two Australians.
Yeah.
And two US Opens.
Yes.
Not so good on the clay French. Frank.
I was runner up at Paris.
You were indeed.
And
I know
won
that.
The Italian. On clay, I won Monte Carlo on clay, so I could play reasonably well on clay.
So I think your nemesis on the clay was Jagoslav Dobny.
I played him
in Wimbledon.
I beat him at Wimbledon. I beat him in the Italian. I beat him at Monte Carlo.
Yes,
but he was one of the top clay court players of his day.
And when you played him at Wimbledon, Frank, it said that you knew you were probably better than him on grass, but you were very nervous and you lost the first set 4-6 before you gathered yourself and steamrolled him. But even the great Frank Sedgman, nervous at Wimbledon, it must be... It's like playing in a grand final or whatever.
Yeah,
it must be a fantastic thing to walk onto that court and have royalty there and the crowd and the strawberries and the champagne and you are part of it and to be out on centre stage at Wimbledon, Frank. Can you remember what it was like?
Yeah, well, I've been to Wimbledon a few times and I'd lost in the final to Falkenberg and Budge Patty.
Yep.
He beat me in the final. And you sort of think, well, God, if I'm ever going to win Wimbledon, you know, because when I got to the final against Drobny, it was about the fifth or sixth time I'd been in the final, Wimbledon. And it was about the third time I'd got close to winning. And I played him, as you say, I lost the first set 6-4. I was 2-2 in the second. And he broke a string in the racket. And you can't believe it, he went crazy.
Did he?
Yeah. And he lost his cool and, you know, he finished up I just had to serve to him in the fourth set and he wouldn't even try and return it. He wouldn't move his feet.
Is that right? Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
Did you ever speak to him about it after? Or?
Well, after we finished, we went into the dressing room and he had his rackets and the Dunlop guy was there, an English gun Dunlop guy. He used Dunlop rackets. He threw the rackets at him. He says, "You cost me Wimbledon," because he, you know, they'd he'd broken a string in his racket, and he reckons it was up to them that, you know,
Is that right?
But couldn't you take another? Didn't you have other rackets like?
Oh yeah, he had about three or four rackets, but he had his favourite racket, and he'd broken a string in it, and he goes mad.
He might have seen the writing on the wall, Frank, that you were going to overrun him, and he thought, well, I'll use this as a bit of a get out.
Well, of course, I'd beaten him before, you know, in the Italian and the Monte Carlo, and I'd sort of got on top of him a bit. I felt that I could have beaten him at Wimbledon. But
so that was in 52?
Yep.
And that was the great year, Phoebe. Tell us about 52, Phoebe.
Well, Frank, 1952, when you won the Wimbledon men's singles final, you also that year won the men's doubles and the mixed doubles at tournament.
Yes.
I mean, no one else has done it.
Well, in those days, you entered the three titles just because you're in Wimbledon. You may as well play in all the titles. And I played with McGregor.
Yeah, Ken McGregor.
We formed a pretty good doubles team because we won the four Grand Slams in the 1 year in 1951. And then we won the three Grand Slams in a row. And we couldn't play the U.S. Grand Slam. We were in the final of the Grand Slam in America in Forest Hills. And it rained and we couldn't play that. And they put it off for another day. Anyway, we played that on a different day and we lost that one. But we'd won seven of the top eight Grand Slams in the 2 years, which was never done before either.
When you change, Frank, and we've got to set the scene here, that back in the 50s and 60s, professionalism in sport was a dirty word. Did you feel ostracised when you actually made a change? Because the people probably don't realise cricketers really didn't get paid. Footballers and VFL footballers, there was tennis, cricket and football, really. They were the major sports in Australia or in Victoria at that stage. And you had to be an amateur. Did you feel ostracised when you became a professional?
I did, yes, because, you know, we'd won the Davis Cup from America, brought it back to Australia, and for 3 years they played the finals of the Davis Cup at Christmas time.
Yep, used to go.
White City.
And Manalto, Adelaide and Sydney. They built special stands. You know how much money they were paying us? 25 shillings a day. And you can wonder why you'd want to turn pro to make some money. But you're spending all your time playing tennis and you weren't making any money.
Yeah, but the establishment ruled back then, didn't they?
Well, they did. And the only way tennis players made money was they were paid by the sporting goods company.
Exhibitions?
No, we didn't get paid for the exhibitions, but we were just paid. I was paid £10 a week by Spalding just to use the racket. And then to get their money, they'd make us go play exhibitions around the country to sell their tennis balls. And that's how, I made my money was just a salary of £10 a week. And I got this offer from Kramer because I'd won Wimbledon and I was the first Australian to win the US championships, US Open. And of course my name, I was sort of making a name for myself as a player. And he offered me $100,000.
Did he?
Really?
To play him a series around America. He'd played Bobby Riggs.
$100,000 back
year
in the 50s.
That was 1952.
Man.
53.
That's
millions in today's language.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
No, that's more. That is serious.
Yeah, well, Kramer played Bobby Riggs.
Yep.
It's a series. Oh, no, played Gonzalez, sorry.
Yep.
He played Gonzalez's series of, and he was promoting himself. He promoted the matches himself.
So he had to go and get sponsorship and organise the venues and whatever
that's
else.
That's right.
And again, you weren't getting access to the top venues, were you? You had to find alternative venues.
Yeah, well, we played at Madison Square Garden. We played at in Los Angeles. You played at one of the indoor stadiums there, you know. And he made a canvas court, which a guy he took. He had a truck and put the canvas court in the truck, and he put it in before we played, say, overnight. He'd go there then during the day and lay the court, and when Kramer and I go and play at, you know, Montreal or Boston or New York and everything, and on this canvas court.
Now, growing up as a spectator and an interested spectator, it was frustrating. Who was the better? The amateur players who were winning Wimbledon, they seemed to get the publicity. They got the publicity because they were representing Australia in Davis Cup, and that was the thing. You people, the pros, weren't getting the accolades.
No.
How long was it before the pros were accepted back that the games you could play against the amateur? How long did that actually take?
Well, I think today's amateurs have got to thank Kramer for the way that he organised the game, because he said to Wimbledon, if you don't pay us some money, if you don't make open tennis come in, we'll ban Wimbledon.
Who will ban it? The pros? Or
yeah.
But you weren't allowed to play at Wimbledon as a pro.
Well, we weren't. I wasn't a pro then, but Kramer went to them and said, if you don't open tennis up and have open tennis, I'll make it sure that I'll get the players not to play at Wimbledon.
Yeah, a bit like World Series cricket, a bit like what's going on in the golf, the LIV tournament going over there. Now, Frank, this is what it says about it. In 1958, Sedgman won the richest tournament in Sydney, called the Sydney Masters, with prize money of $21,000 in 1958. That's what that says here. Sedgman defeated Gonzalez and Trabert in five sets. Kramer designated the Sydney Masters as one of the four professional majors. And then you went on to win the Ampol world title, it says here. And I know you're not being modest because we haven't asked you these things, but I don't think people realise just what an icon you've been, Frank. I'm sure they do, but until you read out things like that, and to be offered $100,000 to go around and tour, mate, it's an extraordinary, career.
Yes, well, you know, it was a strange career because I'd just been married, and I took my wife. She and Kramer gave us a car to travel right around America. He went by car as well. But we played 100 match tour and we drove the whole way. We didn't take a plane or anything. We just played, you know, Boston and then New York and then down to New Orleans or somewhere, you know. And we played the 100 match tour around the States.
So you become...
I'm being, again, self-indulgent because I'm finding this fascinating. I talked earlier about, you know, getting tennis lessons and being on the rackets were your photograph, Pancho Gonzalez and Lou Ho. They were the three.
Yeah.
Now, to me, as a kid growing up, I stand to be corrected, so correct me. You were the steady player. Now, Pancho Gonzalez had an incredible serve. Is that right?
Is that right, yes.
And Lou Hode was the flamboyant player. Am I correct?
You're correct, yes.
So how do you rate those players?
Well, Gonzalez was, I would say, a great player.
Why?
But he'd lost to Kramer on a tour. So he was sort of put in the background a bit because he'd lost to Jack Kramer. But he'd learned a lot of, because of his playing against Kramer, he'd learnt a fair bit about, you know, handling himself a lot better. He used to throw fits and everything on the court, and you could get on top of him because, you know, he'd lose his temperament, you know.
He didn't win Wimbledon, Gonzalez, did he?
No, he didn't win Wimbledon.
And he just had a great serve.
But he had a big serve, but he learned out a bit, ground shots and volleys and all that. He was a good athlete. And Hody was, he was a guy that, you know, he'd play tremendous tennis one day and the next day he couldn't care less. You know, he just...
Really?
Yeah. He just, you know, so, oh, tennis is just, you know, a game to play, and he made a bit of money out of it. And
Frank, all the great...
He didn't concentrate so much on being a great player.
And all how, how did you... The other thing that I find fascinating with you, how did you stay in the game for so long?
Well, I felt that, you know, that was my business, you know.
So were you before
your trade?
That was my trade.
Okay, so were you before your time, taking this back, we mentioned Stan Nichols, Harry Hopman, you know, Hopman introduced weights and whatever. Yeah. Were you before your time in your approach to the game?
I think I was, yes.
No, you think or no?
I was the first one to use weights. And Hopman even said, oh, you shouldn't use weights because it'll slow you up. He said, you're lifting heavy weights and you're going to get stiff and you're going to do this and that and everything else. But
so who influenced you to lift weights?
Well, just Findlay, Frank Findlay. He talked me into it.
Now, Frank, these names, Ashley Cooper and Rosewall and Fraser and Emerson and Newcomb in later, were they not quite, Newcomb wasn't, but were those other boys weren't quite your era, were they? But were they?
I played a few of them, but they were younger than me.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But great Australian names that the Davis Cup, which has become, it's interesting, but that used to be the hallmark of Australian tennis in December all those years ago in the 60s.
Well, that's when we brought the Davis Cup back to Australia. And that's when we were, you know, playing with enormous crowds.
Yep, absolutely.
And we weren't getting paid.
And you became the world number one in what year were you number?
Oh, well, it'd be about 52, 53.
When you won Wimbledon, probably.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you? Was that a financial
you use that.
It's a great accolade, isn't it, to be the best player in the world?
The other thing, Margaret Court came from Albury. Or Margaret Smith was her name. Is that right that you had something to do with her in her formative years as far as coaching?
Exactly. She came and lived at my house for about 9 months. And she'd use the gym. She used my gym. I was coaching her and I was helping her with the tennis. And I had to put a curtain up in the gym so that when the guys were having a shower, she wasn't, you know, she was not allowed to look at them.
So was she a good player because she was also playing against men? Or training training with men?
I was hitting with her.
Yes.
There was a guy in Melbourne who lived in Queens or in Swanson Street or just up St Kilda way, and I got him to build a court. And we'd practice there every day almost. And I'd get Emerson to come and play and a few of their boys to come and play against her. And she was playing these guys and using weights in the gym and running and doing all the right things, you know, to get fit and be strong.
Was her nemesis Maria Buono? Buono,
oh, well, she could beat her. She could beat
Maria.
Her.
She could beat
Buono.
Her. Could she?
Yeah.
Billie Jean Moffat.
No,
yeah, she, well, never, she was Jean, after that, wasn't she?
Later, a bit
Billie
later.
Jean was frightened to play her. She wouldn't. Billie Jean wouldn't play her because she was. Margaret was hitting the ball too strong. She finished up
volley,
looking. She finished up hitting the ball like a guy, you know. And none of the girls want to play against her.
So your attitudes to life are about as polarised as you can get about with Margaret Smith or Margaret Court now, yeah. and you, because she suffered a lot of criticism about her stance about gay marriage and LGBTQ plus.
That's right, yeah.
But you remained respectful and with her. But that wouldn't have occurred when you were coaching her. But later in life, I suppose, it became because you're into tolerance and inclusion.
Yeah, well, she'd go to church. You know, when she's living at our place, she'd go to church every Sunday in the mornings.
Yep,
she'd play tennis in the afternoon.
And there was a push to take her name off the stadium here, the Margaret Courts, right. Because of that. But can we separate sport from social and political attitudes? I suppose it's a bit hard these days, isn't it?
Well, it's a funny thing that, you know, I had a grandson.
Yeah, I know you have a grandson who's gay.
Gay,
yep. Mm-hmm.
So we knew that, you had to accept it.
Yeah, you
families
do.
Have that. You can't change it, can you?
And there's nothing wrong with it.
But
if you're brought up like Margaret, I can't understand people why people would want to take her name off the stand because she was an outstanding player. People might just disagree with that, but
yeah.
So what was your attitude to people like? You might have gone and watched them play. John McEnroe, was he great for the game, wasn't he? He was a fantastic player. Boris Becker, all the great names. There's some fantastic names that that you have paved the way for, Frank.
Yeah, that's right.
What did you think of someone like Nick Kyrgios, John McEnroe? What do you have an opinion about Nick?
Oh, well.
You have a good opinion
about
Nick.
I don't know him very well at all. You know, I don't know whether he knows me, but...
He would know you. Don't you worry about that.
You know, you just wonder what goes on in his mind because he can play tennis okay, but how can you play tennis and be talking to the people sitting in the stand or...
But it might be his way of just overcoming.
The umpires,
might be just his way of overcoming the nervous anxiety that he has. Maybe I don't know. It's
I don't know
the reverse psychology of it all. Now we haven't spoken a lot about.
Well, I was just going to say some other talents that I found frustrating. I don't know about you being a player yourself, Philippoussis.
Well, you know, they play and they get handed accolades and all that sort of thing, and I think it goes to their head. They think,
"Oh." Do you think they're as hungry as what you were? Like you were talking before about what you played for, whereas these guys are well remunerated early on in their career.
Yes, right.
So they're not as. Do you think they're not as hungry as what their predecessors were?
Well, I think you're right because, you know, you wonder why they. Go into tantrums and all that sort of thing and, you know, put up with abuse and all that and they hand the abuse back at umpires. And, I don't know.
You did nothing, none of that, Frank. You just played the game.
Oh, yeah, I was just concentrating on the game.
But that's what players did in that day. There was no tantrums at all.
Well, you had to keep your mind on the game.
The other thing that fascinated me back then watching it on TV was that... the camaraderie or the respect the players had for one another. And I can remember watching at Kooyong, and if there was a wrong call and you knew as the opponent it was a wrong call. That ball was out. I've seen players just stand there. They wouldn't argue with the umpire, but they'd let the opponent serve the ball and wouldn't attempt a shot.
Yeah.
Because of the error that was made earlier. You wouldn't find that today.
No, not at all. No.
I was going to ask you about Djokovic. I suppose do you keep an eye on the tennis? Do you still?
Oh yeah.
He's. I know we tend to say that the star of the day seems to be the best ever, but he's got to be almost up there, hasn't he?
Oh yeah, he's a good player. But the thing that amazes mostly my wife and myself is the way that the younger players now in Europe are appearing.
Yep.
In our day, there was hardly any continental players, you know, in Europe.
Was that because of the war? My theory is that they went through a First World War and a Second World War. Australia, people probably don't realise, was together with America, but Australia were very, very dominant in tennis. Now, we had none of this upheaval, and it was the second sport to cricket in summertime. Hence, we had all these great tennis players. But now there's been settlement worldwide, so these Europeans are now starting to come through. Am I right or wrong?
You're right, exactly right. Because in Melbourne, you could play Saturdays and Sundays during the war.
Every church had a tennis court back then, didn't they?
The churches had courts. But I remember the only thing happened was pretty hard to get some tennis balls because they weren't making a lot of tennis balls.
Yeah.
But we could play all the time. During the war and, after the war. And I think, Don, you're right, that, the Europeans couldn't do it. They weren't playing.
Now, you must have you have a great opinion of a bloke called Rafa Nadal. A star on and off the field he is. He is almost the epitome of what your sport is about, surely. Have you ever met him or do you keep an eye on him?
I don't. I haven't hardly talked to him. But I just...
He would know exactly who you are. Yep. Yeah.
But I like to see him play because he can hit that ball, he's making the ball jump and you've got to be able to hit the ball above your head almost.
Yep, you can make it talk.
Because it's got so much spin on the ball.
Now, Frank, we haven't spoken a lot about the women players because in all... categorically speaking or clinically speaking, in when you were playing, there weren't that many... women's tennis wasn't really on the scene. It wasn't considered to be in the same realm as men's tennis, was it?
Oh, no. Well,
Margaret led the way.
Margaret was the outstanding player.
And then Yvonne came.
Wasn't there an American girl...
Billie Jean King.
No, before this. I'm going back in the 40s, 30s. She was a very dominant player, American.
Yes, that's right. Household name. So much of a household name I can't think of it, but I know exactly what you're talking about, Don. Who was that, Russell? No, I know who that...
yeah, I should know.
American girl.
Yep.
She won Wimbledon. Kitty, she was Kitty just dominant.
Well, I played with... Mixed doubles, I won the tournament with Doris Hart.
Doris Hart, yeah.
But she wasn't as good as Louise Brough. Brough the girl you're
thinking? No. Anyway. Now, the other... I'm being against... Maybe I should ask you this off air. You grew up in Blackburn. I thought it was Mont Albert. Where I lived in North Box Hill, you've got a park named after you, the Frank Sedgman Park.
Is it?
Didn't you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Okay,
no.
Well, it's there. So where did you go to school? Because Blackburn was orchard. It was country
when
you were growing up. I think it's finished at about Box Hill or Mont Albert suburbia.
Right.
Where?
I went to Blackburn State School and I lived in Main Street, Blackburn, next to the railway line.
Yeah.
And I'd walk from there to Blackburn State School.
Which is on the corner of Whitehorse Road and I think it was...
Middlebrother Road.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And anyway, after I got to the fourth grade, I went to Box Hill High.
Yeah.
And I got my intermediate. And my dad said, well, I can't afford for you to go to school to get your leaving, which you needed, to get a good job. He said, we moved from Blackburn to Brunswick because he was working at a fibre plaster place in Brunswick and was next to a factory where they made the ceilings and all that sort of stuff and all the walls in plaster. And he was a fixer. He'd fix the ceilings and I'd hit the ball against the wall of the factory. I'd come home from school I'd just keep hitting the ball against the wall. I volleyed against the wall for about an hour, a couple of hours a night. That's how I became a good volleyer. And you could almost play tennis on the roads. There was no cars running around like there is now in Union Street, Brunswick. And anyway, I joined the VRI Tennis Club, which is in the park up near Carlton and that, you know. So that's where I spent most of my time, you know. And then the Spaldings sent you on your do exhibitions of the weekend, and you'd get in the car and go to Aubrey, or you'd go to Warrnambool or somewhere like that and play in exhibitions with the tennis members there and just to sell tennis balls.
Now, Frank, here's a question without notice. You've been through that, you're around for the First World War, you're around for the Second World War, you're around for Vietnam, you've seen the world change like no, we can't imagine. What have you noticed in your travels, in your journey through life, Frank? What have you noticed that the biggest change is that the technology, the iPhone, the internet, the relaxing of, I don't know, what can you put your finger on anything that staggered you over the years?
The thing that staggers me now is when we wanted to make a phone call, you'd have to find a telephone box, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Now you see people walking down the street talking.
They can watch you playing Wimbledon now if they wanted to on their phone. Yeah. They can walk down the street. It's unbelievable. The things that are, you're staggered at. You glad you've lived in the era you have, or would you like to be just starting out?
I often say to my wife, I wish they'd taught us something about computers, because, you know, there's Instagram and... Yeah. Twitter and all this stuff.
Oh, well, Don and I are just as bad now, mate, so don't feel bad.
I can't understand all that stuff.
But you were a product of the Depression.
Yeah.
Obviously, you were too young. I think you were born in the late 20s. Now, that must have really, you know, we cannot relate to the Depression. It must have been terribly hard. It must have had an effect upon your parents. How did that affect your growing up as a boy?
Well... you had to have food coupons to get food. In my, you know, when I was going to Box Hill High, you had to have, you know, we'd get a week's supply of food through the little food coupons. You know, you couldn't buy butter or you couldn't buy meat.
You just went without, didn't you?
Yeah, well, you went without, or if you had a food coupon, you could buy a steak or a chop. But that's how it happened. But as you say, you know, my father was only earning £5 a week, I think it was, you know, and you didn't have a lot of money to live on. And I can remember when I said I played football, you know, or tried to play football at Carlton, I wore ordinary shoes.
With stops in?
Not even with stops in.
Really?
I had to borrow. I remember borrowing some football boots to go and play football sometimes, and you never thought you'd you know, you think you'd just go and buy a pair of football boots without, but we were so poor that you couldn't buy the boots. He wouldn't let me buy boots.
So almost finally, Frank, you are also a very sharp golfer. And do you still play? You were a member, I think, at Woodlands?
Yeah, that's right.
And what did you get down to?
I was on two for about two. 6 months. And I played off three.
Did you? I know. It was a leading question. I knew exactly that because every time we go to Woodlands, they say this is the home of Frank Sedgman, the golf course. Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, a tough track.
I didn't win the championship there. I was runner-up in the championship there. But I could play reasonably well, but... Yeah,
I think you're a natural at anything, my friend. Having watched you go around that tennis court, you are a natural. You are a natural, just the way you
move. Phoebe?
The other thing is you're into racing. Horses. You've owned a few. What's the best one you've owned? And what have you? And what did that horse win?
Well, I was a member of the Mornington Racing Club, and... we bought a horse called Ariba. And Ariba won about 900,000 in stake money. And they still have a name or a race named after him.
Yeah.
At Flemington.
Mm.
And because he was a great sprinter. But like horses, they get injured or they hurt themselves. And... So he only lasted about 3 years, you know. He didn't sort of live his life out as he should have because of the injury. But we had a lot of other horses, not as good as him. And, you know, you just try and get a horse that can pay its way.
Phoebe?
Frank, you were. I just want to go back to tennis for a moment. You were travelling the world in the 50s and the 60s, and I'm curious to know if there were any unusual or strange opportunities that you got or people that you got to meet during that period, such as royalty or did Hollywood ever come good knocking?
One. Yeah, well, I spent a lot of time in California and I spent a month there because of this guy that Hopman introduced me to, paid our expenses, and he says, "Oh, go and learn, you know, go to California and play and learn." Perry Jones was the president of the Los Angeles Tennis Club, and this is where I actually met Gonzalez.
Film stars? Did you meet any film stars? Yep.
Yeah, well, not really, you know.
No.
They'd come and play.
And want to brush shoulders with you, Frank.
So what happened at Los Angeles? You're saying you met Perry Jones. What happened there?
Oh, well, he said, "Oh, you come and play. You can play and just play club tennis and play with the pro there." And hit balls with him, and on they had the concrete courts.
Yeah,
big hard courts, which we never had in Australia. And you could learn how to play the attacking game there. The Yanks used to always, you know, play serve and volley all the time, and that's what you had to do to win a match, is play serve and volley.
Well,
were you ever asked to do private coaching for people?
Oh, I did that a bit, yes. Yeah, my dad and I and another guy, Keith Rogers, went to... We had a school down at Geelong Grammar. And we'd go down there every week and to coach the boys there. And then we coached at Grace Park Tennis Club in Hawthorne. and built up. I had a good mate, Keith Rogers, and my dad, he started to teach how to play tennis, and so I'd go with him and help them when I was at home, you know, just to help them get the players to come and learn how to play tennis. But they had these workouts at Grace Park and then, of course, down at Geelong Grammar.
Well, now, Frank, there was a film out called The Enigma Code, which was about Alan Turing, who invented the first computer. Back, he broke the German numbers code to end the war probably 2 years before it should have ended.
No kidding, eh?
And they said this of him. They said, sometimes it's the very people who no one imagines anything of do things that no one can imagine. You are one of those people that no one can imagine all the things you've done, Frank. You're a star. You're a great Australian sportsman. And it has been a delight to speak to someone who is approaching 100 years of age. And I keep saying that. I'm not trying to take the mickey out of you. I think that you are so sharp and so fantastic, and you're a credit and a great Australian, Frank Sedgman.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
Thank
well,
you very.
I've seen you play, and I've seen Don play. I'd go and watch you. You'd go and watch me play tennis.
Well, I'm just in awe of you because, as I said, growing up and your face, you know, we had nothing much to do back in those days. But Frank Sedgman, Pancho Gonzalez, and Luo, you're on the tennis rackets.
Yeah,
it's a real honour. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.